Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society.
And a rock star guest.
Ooh, you came up with the adjective today.
I did.
That is a good one.
He's a rock star.
Yeah.
And see, not just because of everything that he's done recently, but I was telling him before we started the mics, this is Alan, was a guest at our rodeo club, the Rotary Club in Astoria, about, we decided, 8 or 9 years ago.
Probably 9 years ago, yeah.
And your story, your personal story, is just incredibly moving to me and inspirational. I think it's incredibly inspirational. So I'm very excited to have you as a guest tonight, and we should get right to it. But I do need to say, one of our guests from just a couple of months ago, I think we had him in August, your father-in-law, Alana, Norm, passed away this past week. So we're very sad. And I'm so glad that we got him on the air, though, and that we could record his stories and some of them. I wish we'd brought him back for a 2 or 3 4-parter.
I know. But yes, hearing his voice on that radio has been just such a gem because we've played it over and over. So that's really nice. It was a nice...
I wish we'd brought him back. Although we did actually keep the mics going after the 30 minutes we recorded, like another 10 or 15 minutes. So
yes.
You know, it was the only time I met him, but I was very charmed by him. So my thoughts are certainly with you and Mark and everybody else in your extended family. Very large family. He touched so many lives.
Yep. 90 years old, almost 90 and a half.
Wow.
So born and raised right here in Clatsop County. Fisherman forever.
But a good life.
Yep. Very good.
Yeah. Yes. Would have liked another 10 years, but... Can't argue with 90.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe. Well, see, that's kind of like my dad passed 92 this year, and it's sad, but he lived a very good life, and you know, he was at a point where it would not have been comfortable for him to continue. So, but let's what a downer. I'm sorry, Alan. He's sitting here going, "Wow, what
a..." It'd be tough to follow that.
Yeah. So let's get to the history highlights. These are things that happened tomorrow, so you can be smart with your friends and family at lunch. Speaking of which, I am full of turkey, by the way. I might be part turkey now.
Are you stuffed?
I am stuffed.
Of course you are.
I might be part turkey. All right, but these are things that happened on November 29th, 1775. Sir James Jay invents invisible ink.
Oh, that's fun.
Wow. But how did he know it?
1775, too. Yeah, how did he know it?
It makes me laugh how early that is, 1775. 1847. Native Americans kill Washington state pioneers Marcus and Narcissa Whitman and 12 others in Walla Walla, Oregon. History has recorded this as the Whitman Massacre, but I think perhaps it's being somewhat reevaluated.
Oh, probably.
But definitely Native Americans killed Whitman and his party.
See, you're learning, Mac.
I am learning.
You are.
I might be old, but I can learn a little bit. We actually portrayed one of the survivors of the Whitman Massacre at one of our early talking tombstones, and it freaked out. It was still a time when we had little kids showing up because they thought it was like a haunted house thing.
Right.
And we had this 12 or 13 year old girl portraying a survivor, and she got very graphic.
Oh no!
About ripping hearts out and things like that. And these little kids' eyes just got really big, and mom decided it wasn't for them.
Right.
1864, another one, Sand Creek Massacre. Peaceful band of about 150 Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho Native Americans are massacred by Colonel John Shivington's Colorado volunteers at Sand Creek, Colorado. 1864.
Yeah.
1935, physicist Erwin Schrödinger publishes his famous thought experiment, Schrödinger's Cat. Hmm. Anybody that watches Big Bang Theory knows about this. That's the reason I threw it in there. 1972, co-founder of Atari, Nolan Bushnell, releases Pong, the first commercially successful video game, and it showed up in Andy Capp's Tavern in Sunnyvale, California.
Oh, interesting. I knew you'd like that one.
That was almost going to be my history highlight of the day.
Of course.
Just think of the impact of video games.
Right.
That was the first video game I played.
Was it? Was it
really? Yeah, I remember playing it. Squash, too. He had both of them on the same...
Squash, really? Wow. So I have a story about Pong. I had a friend in 95 that ran a state museum, and they were doing an 80s exhibit, and his whole staff had debated whether it was too soon. And you know, we all lived this. It was just 5 years ago. And they did the exhibit anyway, 95, and they put Pong in the exhibit where you could actually play it. And two little boys, obviously brothers. One was like 8, one was 5. They're just staring at it one day, about a week after they open the exhibit. And he's walking through the gallery and he sees these two boys just staring at Pong, not even trying to play it. And the little one goes, "What's that?" And the older one says, "That's what video games were like in the old days." So he knew he'd done the right thing.
Yes.
1981, Natalie Wood drowns. 2001, George Harrison dies from the Beatles. But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, 1947. Despite strong Arab opposition, the United Nations votes for the partition of Palestine and the creation of an independent Jewish state.
Yes.
And thankfully, there's been peace ever since in the Middle East.
Right.
But definitely had the most impact on history.
Yeah, you got that one right.
What did I miss?
Well, this one I'm surprised you missed because you love the U.S. Post Office. So 1903, an inquiry into the U.S. Postal Service demonstrates the government has lost millions in fraud.
In fraud?
1903.
Wow.
That's why
I didn't like that one.
It's a service, right? It's a service.
That's right.
And then 1832, Louisa May Alcott, the writer of Little Women, was born.
Yeah, Little Women.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, good stuff.
Good stuff. We have good stuff here today. In case you haven't recognized his voice yet, Alan Evans, thank you for being here with us.
Well, thank you guys for having me today.
And you've lived quite the life. I mean, you have a good history, a good story to tell and share. So where do we even start?
So I would say, what is your background story? Where did you grow up and how did you get to the point where you were 8-9 years ago talking to my Rotary Club and telling us your life story?
Well, it was a long story. So, I was homeless for 27 years. Before that, I was born into an addictive family and lived through some abuse and some sexual abuse and some physical abuse when I was young. I was hung by my father when I was 11. I was found by a neighbor. I ended up going to a home in Inyo Kern, California, and I was a pretty angry kid. Couldn't understand a lot of stuff. Drug abuse at a very, very, very young age. I was a full-blown methamphetamine addict by the time I was 13. Hmm. I was doing anything I could to not feel. And looking back now, I understood that. And that was my story. I started running away. And, I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. Yeah. And I just was homeless from 13 years old until I was a little over 38.
So did you run away from that home then? Because you said you did end up in a home.
Yeah,
did you...
I ended up going back to my mom's.
Okay.
But she was working two jobs and, she didn't even care if I was home or not. So that was kind of it. And so I lived in dugouts and cars and I've been all over the United States homeless, to just about every soup kitchen you can think of, everywhere. And the funny thing was I could walk in a door and ask for help. And they would tell me, well, you just need to quit using drugs and your life would change. And I tried to explain to them, if I quit using drugs, I was kind of stuck with what was between my ears. And that was a heck of a thing. I needed so much more than one place could give me. So I could get a meal at a meal site, and I can get emergency shelter at an overnight shelter. But what I needed help with was a broken heart. And that concept never stuck. Anywhere you went, you could not receive the resources you truly need. Some people, they could get help, but I would say 90% of the people that were on the streets, and the streets were full of guys like me, back in the 80s and the 90s and all the way into, the 2000s.
How do you get from one place to the other when you're 13, 14, 15? I mean, are you hitching rides?
Yeah, hitchhiking in the 70s was easy.
And what makes you decide to go from this community to that community?
When you feel like you're recognized. When you feel like people see you the same way that you see yourself. As you begin to find communities and then you see the same people multiple times and they know your story or they're asking too many questions, you don't know how to answer questions when you're young, then, it's time to go someplace else where you won't be recognized. And I mean, it took me 27 years to figure out that wherever you go, there you are. It truly did, because I was constantly running from myself. I wasn't running from a situation per se, but any place I showed up, it was a new story, new people. They could view me differently than everybody else seen me. And every time I would get, or people would get close to me, I needed to be someplace else.
And how do you find the resources when you go to that new town? I mean, because you said you were doing drugs, Mm-hmm. You were trying to deal with a lot of things, but you also knew you needed that meal. You needed a place to sleep. Like, how do you get that presence of mind to do that, to do what's right?
Well,
do what's right for your body, at least for the
homelessness
moment.
Is one of those things that happen everywhere, and they've been happening for years. The population has changed dramatically, but it's all been the same. In the late 70s, early 80s, people were running from place to place. They just were. Everybody was hitchhiking. I mean, you just got places. And when you show up at a community, there were already people there that you connect to, because homeless people have a tendency to go to the same places. And so it wasn't hard to find out where resources were. And towns weren't that far apart either. I mean, from Victorville, California to Pensacola, Florida was my first trek across the United States on Interstate 10. And you went from location to location. You know, a town would be 8 miles down the road, a new set of resources. And you work your way all the way across through Arizona and New Mexico and Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi and Florida.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I was in New York for a little bit, Chicago, Michigan, kind of worked my way all around, then ended up back in the high desert in Victorville for a little bit, and then kind of bounced around to Las Vegas and you name it, I was there.
So you say that somebody says, well, just get off the drugs, like it's an easy thing. Were there any people that you encountered in this time period that, looking back, you were like, gosh, that really was somebody trying to help me, not just somebody stupidly saying, get off the drugs, get a job? I mean, were there somebody that, you know, actually really reached out in a way that, looking several back now, you're people. Like, gosh, I wish I had.
Well, several people, but I was incapable, you know, and that's kind of the way we look at our population today. We look at them and we say, you know, they're kind of a pain in the neck, you know, they're a nuisance, all of these things, but everybody's fighting a battle on the inside that we don't understand. And usually everybody else seen me differently than the way I seen myself. I think what we don't get is that people need so much more than just a suggestion or a meal. They have so many different obstacles they face to reenter society that you need to be able to help them with all of them, and or they're not successful.
So on your journey, you basically did a circle around the United States. What brought you north to Oregon?
I committed a lot of crime around the United States, just surviving, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, drug abuse, you do these things, theft, you know, breaking and enterings, all of the stuff that goes with being a defensive mode, survival mode. So you always feel like you're running from being arrested. Mm-hmm. That's where I ended up. I came from Las Vegas to Astoria, Oregon, because there was a guy here who I knew from Arizona, and he had an apartment here. And then that didn't work out. And then I ended up back in Portland. And I was in Portland for about 4.5 months, and I lived under Burnside Bridge. Okay. I had the second coldest night I've ever experienced in my life there. There was a whole group of us huddled up, and there was a lot of the same resources today that there was 20 years ago. You'd get cold and you'd get wet, and you can turn your clothes in and get more clothes from a clothing closet, basically. You ate almost at the same exact place 20 years ago for your meals.
In downtown.
And the low barrier help was not much different than it is today. I got one of the best gifts I ever got was a brown tarp because it kept me dry. And I mean, when I finally figured out that a tarp was the way to go, because at least you can keep dry and it would keep the heat in from your body heat. And it was great. And then finally, one night, it got so cold that I was afraid to fall asleep. I was soaking wet and I was under this tarp. And I remember being afraid to fall asleep because I thought I was going to die. And so that was it. Me and two other guys came back over, hitchhiked over, and got to Seaside. And I remember being, and it was cold and miserable. It was December 27th, exactly 20 years ago, next month.
Wow.
And I went to every door I could find, said, look, I'm broke, I'm homeless, I'm addicted, I don't want to die, I don't want to feel this way no more. And I tried to get food stamps. They told me I needed identification. I tried to get ID. They told me I needed a residence. I wanted a residence, but I had no money. And I realized that I can commit a crime and live on the same road I was living. But if I got arrested, I'd get 3 meals and a bed in jail. Mm-hmm. So I realized that getting arrested became getting rescued. And that's exactly what I did. I broke into a house in Gearhart, Oregon. I found some checks. I made a check out to myself. I took a broken Social Security card and I took it to the bank at Safeway in Seaside and handed it over the counter. And the lady looked at me and she said, "Really?" I said, "Really." And so she called the police. And Billy Barnes and Officer Shad showed up to arrest me and then took me to the police department in Seaside, where they called in Sergeant Mark Whistler, who was the head of narcotics at the time. And he sat down in a room with me and he said, "Tell me your story." And I told him my story from beginning to end. And he said, "You're not a bad guy. You're just sick. You're broken." And he said, "I want to help you." And so him, Officer Jason Schirmerhorn, they wrapped some resources around me. He got into a small home in Seaside. I got a job. I was going to meetings, got on my feet, got a driver's license, got a truck. And I went back to him and I said, "I got an idea. I want to start an organization that people can come in the door without a penny in their pocket. And I want to call it Thugs Off Drugs."
I love the name of your
I
first one.
I do too.
Some people did and some people didn't, right?
Well, because I could see where it's kind of a marketing nightmare, but yeah. You know, actually, I still loved it.
It was, if you think about it, it did its job. Mm-hmm. Because you either loved it or you hated it, but you were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was for quite some time. So I went back to Jason and Mark and said, "I'd like to do this." And it was 7 months after I got clean. And they said, "All right, let's do it." So they were my first two board members. We had a couple other recovering drug addicts on, you know, we called ourselves Two Felonies and a Misdemeanor, was our board of directors. We kind of got a kick out of it. And we raised a little bit of money and went to the city of Seaside and said, "I got this idea." And they gave us $1,000 of seed money and we opened up a small building on the highway. And everything was history from there. Within 6 months, we were housing 67 men, women, and children.
People and what year was that again?
That was in 2002.
God. That's amazing. So back up just a little bit. I'm fascinated that this police sergeant and narcotics officer in Seaside actually takes the time to tell me your story.
He was the sheriff. He was working for the sheriff's department.
Sheriff's department. Yeah. Had that ever happened to you before? Were a law enforcement or somebody affiliated with law enforcement stopped instead of just your trouble, you're a bad guy, that actually stopped to get your story?
I think that he understood the importance of trauma-informed care. You know, him and Jason both were people. I mean, Jason and Mark are two of my best friends today, still, after all these years. But they had this, they actually talk to you rather than at you. There's this stigma with the police departments and in most places that, you know, it's us against them and we're the bad people and they're the good people and they want to impose something. But he just took the time and listened to me and he said, "I want to help you." And he did. And they wrapped services around me. I mean, him and Jason and there was three or four different people that, you know, kind of got together and said, "You're worth helping." Mm-hmm. And which was kind of cool. And when I went back to them, you know, they were a little leery. Mm-hmm. You know, "You want to do what? Thugs Off Drugs with Z's?" okay. But because they spent time, both of them did a lot of time with me over a 6 or 7 month period of time. You know, it was pretty amazing. And I think that right there showed me that it was possible.
Mm-hmm. And so 7 months of being clean, at that point, you are dealing with what's in your head. So what did you do?
Well, I think that I learned some stuff in the program. And I learned some stuff from church. And I understood that I suffered from a broken heart. And I had to stop the voices in my head, the survival pieces. And it could not happen without the support of people. And so God kind of placed the right people in my life at the right time to help me have a different thought process than before. I mean, I still suffer from trauma. Sure. I mean, and PTSD, and I have for years, but those first couple of years were tough. And I went through probably 3 or 4 complete emotional breakdowns over a matter of time, because I went from breaking into a house in Gearheart to being the CEO of an organization that houses, at the end of this year, will house nearly 650 people a night, one of the largest homeless reentry programs in the nation.
So reentry is the key word there, because I love this. This is what is, you know, really is so important about what you do, because you not only operate or own our emergency shelter, which is important and necessary, but that's the one night that you talk about. That's the few nights off the street. You started a reentry program. So tell us about that and what was really, I mean, your background that led to doing that program.
Yeah, I think the way the communities look at the issue is we see problems and we attempt to solve them with money. And we, instead of looking at the problem from the top down, what we wanted to do was look at the problem from the bottom up. The more we understood about people and the more we understood about the journey that they face trying to just climb up to be a person, the more we realized that there had to be stages to that. And I think the key piece for me is I became an adoptive parent in the state of Oregon. I became the first foster parent with a criminal history. I became the first adoptive parent in the state of Oregon with a history like mine. And then I adopted a boy named Eli. And when Eli came to us, he was in the third grade. And he couldn't read and he couldn't write. Never went to school a day in his life. So I took him to Gearheart Elementary School and they did an IEP on him, an individual education plan, where they evaluated the obstacles that he faced to be at grade level. And sitting around a table was a person that could help him read, a person that could help him write, a tutor, a counselor, a mental health provider. There were 7 people sitting around this table. And I realized that if he would have to go down the street to learn to read, and then down the street to learn to write, down the street to get help for mental health issues, down the street for this, that this kid never would have made it. By the way, he graduated 4 years ago, and he's a good kid. But I had this epiphany that day. And they also did an ACEs survey on him, where they evaluated the trauma that he lived through. And they offered opportunities, not just for education and get him at grade level, but they offered opportunities to heal at the same time, which was, and I just had this mind-blowing thing and said, this is what we need to do with our population, because we were serving people and they would get on their feet, they'd get a job, they'd get an apartment, and 7 months later, they were back at our door because they needed so much more than just the hand up. So we changed the whole concept of our program 10 years ago, and now we have a reentry program that's data-driven. We have our own proprietary database. We collect all of this information, and we make every decision to help people based off of the information we get from them when they come in the door.
We're talking a major spreadsheet here.
Yeah, I'm kind of astounded at that.
I remember learning about this when I first started working here, because I was with Clatsop Community Action on their board at the time. And I remember the day they said that you guys had bought this new software system and you guys were just going to jump right in and make sure you're doing everything that you could to get all of this data and all this information to capture the perfect picture.
We built it. So I'll tell you a tiny story is that my brother and I were separated at a very young age because of the trauma piece. And so we find each other. Let me see. It's been almost 8 years now. We find each other and we decide to meet MOP in Oregon. And I'm all excited. I'm telling him what we're doing. I'm telling about the IRPs, the individual reentry plans, and all of this exciting stuff. And he says, do you know what I do? And I said, no. He said, I work for Dell. We create databases that track things like shopping networks and all of these things. And he pulls up this tablet and he said, this is what's happening in Tokyo. And he's swiping his hand across it. And I said, what are the chances of putting me in a room with your team to see if we can build a system that will allow us to track the obstacles people face? And so we went live with Tactical Demographics 7 years ago. And we're coming into our 3.0 model right now, and the data we're pulling is unbelievable.
And this is huge for getting resources.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Does this, your database and the information that it tells you, do you share that with other organizations around the nation that are trying to do the same types of things?
Well, we've got a lot of interest on a national level right now. their data is collected a certain way for funding streams through a system called HMIS, Home Management Information System. But it's a data collection tool for funding opportunities because we can gauge how many homeless people there are or how many people in eater-in communities. And then HUD gauges the amount of money they give states based off of that information. That was not usable data for us. So now our model is really catching fire because we feel like we've created a best practice for homeless reentry that's data-driven and trauma-informed. And when you put those things together, we've got on-the-spot push-button data that nobody's ever seen before.
And don't you have an incredible, I remember one of the times I've heard you speak, an amazing statistic of success at this point.
Like the recidivism rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we went to this model, our recidivism rate changed dramatically because we were looking at probably 40%. But since we started the model that we've started, about 80% of the people who enter the reentry program go back into sustainable housing and communities. And then after 3 years, that number still stays up there because they learn to heal and they get a toolbox. They understand what it's like to be clean and sober and live life the right way. So we've been very fortunate, yeah.
So from Seaside, Oregon, you're in a few more places now. Tell us about that.
So we grew from Seaside to Yamhill County, from Yamhill County to Lincoln County. So that was three counties there. 5 years ago, we moved into Tillamook County. And then just 2 years ago, we made a partnership between Betsy Johnson and Jordan Schnitzer to take over the old Wapato Jail, 155,000 square foot building that we're just finished a $4 million remodel on. And we've been open with 126 beds for just over a year. We're adding 200 more beds before the end of the year. And we're building a new facility in Lincoln City right now for 69 more beds. We're finishing up our Naval Command Center we bought in Tillamook to add another 39 beds there. And the beginning of and by the way, we just decided within the last 2 weeks to open a warming center in Seaside in our original building.
Oh, really?
From 20 years ago.
Do you still own that building?
We never owned it.
Okay.
But it sat empty for quite some time, and there's a need for collecting data in communities, and that's kind of the direction we're going now. So that'll open up with, we're not sure exactly how many beds. We're going to base it off of need, but we open up that in a week. And then our partnership there is with CCA, the City of Seaside, Sunset Empire Parks and Recreation, and Helping Hands.
So I'm just a guy walking down the street, and I listen to this as a podcast someday, and Helping Hands, how do I help? What can I do to help you guys do
what you do? I mean, interest is important. Learn more about our story. Learn about the reality of what it is we do and how we do it, and help us spread the word. You know, hope is infectious. The more people that we get to understand the importance of hope and the importance of what we do, the bigger our voice becomes and the more interest we gather in that. And that's what we want to do more than anything else is we want people to be interested, engaged, and we've got a rock star team of people that we would like you to join our team.
You do have an amazing staff, I have to say.
Yes.
Yes.
An amazing story. And thank you. We know you're busy and you're all over the place at this point. So thank you so much for coming and talking to us. But more importantly, thank you for what you've done. You've made an incredible difference in this world. So
it's so much bigger than me, because I would have screwed this up a long time ago, right? I think the important thing is having the right team and building teams of people. When we can do that, then, because they deserve all the glory, they've done an amazing job.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening. Go make some history, and we will catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.